Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Michael Oren is a senior fellow at the Shalom Institute, a Jerusalem-based research and educational institute. He's the author of The Origins of the Second Arab-Israeli War and of 6 Days of War, June 67, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, which became a New York Times national bestseller and earned a number of prizes. Raised in the United States, Dr. Oren immigrated to Israel in 1979. He completed his PhD in history at Princeton and later served as a paratrooper in the Israel Defense Forces, in which he holds the rank of major. He is a veteran of the Lebanon War and served as the Israeli liaison officer to the U.S. Sixth Fleet during the Gulf War. He also acted as a representative of the Prime Minister's Office to the Jewish Underground in the Soviet Union and served as director of interreligious affairs in the government of Yitzhak Rabin. In his new book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America in the Middle East from 1776 to the Present, he draws on thousands of government documents and personal letters to reconstruct the diverse and remarkable ways in which Americans have interacted with the alluring yet often hostile land stretching from Morocco to Iran, from the Persian Gulf to the Bosporus. Its cast of fascinating characters, earnest missionaries, maverick converts, wide-eyed tourists, and even a 19th century George Bush. President Oren's book, the work of an immensely lucid historian and a great storyteller, covers over 230 years of history and is an indispensable work for anyone interested in understanding the roots of America's Middle East involvement today. I'm pleased to welcome back to Allowed at Central Library, Michael B. Oren. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you, Louise. Good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure, thrill, and honor to be back at the Los Angeles Public Library. A great pleasure to be welcomed by strands of Middle Eastern music. Maybe you heard it walking in this evening. And to be greeted by that sci-fi scene outside the movie set. Apparently they're shooting a movie, The Middle East Meets Matrix 4. Imagine, if you will, that you are a high-ranking American diplomat who is sent by your government to conduct negotiations with a representative of a Middle Eastern state that has declared war against the United States. And you're sent to some undisclosed capital in Europe, and you meet the emissary of this Middle Eastern state, and you say to him that the United States bears no animosity whatsoever to the people of his kingdom, nor to any other state in the Middle East. Americans merely want to conduct their trade freely in the Middle East, free of any type of physical threat. The United States, if it has the opportunity, wants to impart some of its values to the peoples of the Middle East. The United States does not want war. Now imagine if this emissary listens to these words, listens to this offer, and then turns to you, the representative, and says, no, we don't want peace with you. In fact, we are committed to conducting war against you. We have a holy book that says your state, being an infidel state, must be enslaved by our state. And in fact, in the course of conducting this war, if any of our soldiers are killed, they will alight immediately to paradise. How then would you, as the high-ranking American emissary, how would you react? Well, if your response was, well, the United States has no alternative but to defend itself, the United States has no alternative but to go to war in the Middle East, you would be echoing the reply given by one high-ranking American representative who conducted precisely such a negotiation. His name was Thomas Jefferson. The month was March, the year 1785, and Jefferson had been sent by the Congress to meet with the representative of Tripoli, what is today Libya. His name was Abdul Rahman al-Najjar. Libya was one of the four so-called Barbary states, which included Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. They were pirate states. The United States had, at that time, a very fragile economy, heavily dependent on its foreign trade. About 20% of America's trade traveled through the Middle East, and pirates from these Barbary states were attacking these ships and enslaving their crews. And the worst part about it was the United States had no means to respond to this threat. The United States had managed to emerge from its Revolutionary War without a single gunboat intact. And more problematic still, the United States, loosely confederated under the Articles of Confederation, had no central government, no president, no means of raising taxes to even create a navy that could begin to respond. Now, Jefferson believed that the United States should federate. He believed that the United States should fight. He believed that by paying off the pirates, such as the Europeans had done for centuries, merely encouraged those pirates to perpetrate further piracy against the United States. But many Americans disagreed with him. Many Americans, first of all, didn't want a navy. A navy could turn its guns on the nascent democratic institutions of the United States. A navy could get the United States bogged down in all sorts of nasty European conflicts. But more to the point, many Americans, led by John Adams, believed that the United States would be better off merely paying bribes to the pirates. Going to the war in the Middle East was too expensive. Americans had no stomach for it. And during John Adams' presidency, indeed, the United States was paying about one-fifth of its federal budget for Middle Eastern bribes. Many Americans preferred not to fight the pirates, but to negotiate with them, preferred to palliate the pirates rather than get the United States caught up in an open-ended, bloody conflict in the distant Middle East. Today, more than 220 years later, Americans are confronting similar situations in the Middle East and are being forced to make familiar choices, whether to fight or to negotiate, whether to palliate their enemies in the region, or whether to destroy them. Now, these are fateful decisions are being made by these founding fathers. And many Americans today would be unaware that the founding generation of their own country had to face these similar situations. Many Americans today are, I would guess, unaware of the century-long legacy in the region. And this is a rich and multifaceted heritage of war and of statecraft, of altruism and beneficence, of artistic imaginings and swashbuckling adventure. Many Americans, again, I would reckon, believe that U.S. involvement in the Middle East began sometime after World War II, with the advent of the Arab-Israeli conflict, with America's deepening dependence on Middle Eastern oils, with the coming of the Cold War to the region. Many Americans would be shocked to hear that not only Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, but also Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln had Middle Eastern policies, that during the Civil War, some 500 Egyptian soldiers served and fought on North American soil, that one of the people implicated in the assassination plot against Lincoln and other members of administration escaped to and was arrested in Egypt. Many Americans would be astonished to hear that the original Statue of Liberty showed a veiled Arab woman holding a torch, and that the original lyrics of the Star-Spangled Banner spoke of humbled Middle Easterners bowing down to the victorious flag of the United States. I was one of those people. Once upon a time, I too would have been surprised to hear such astonishing facts. About two decades ago, when I was a graduate student, I was listening to a lecture on Arab history, on the history of Egypt in the 19th century, when the professor mentioned, really parenthetically, that in the late 1860s, early 1870s, a group of Civil War veterans, Confederate and Union officer veterans, had reunited and had gone to Egypt to help modernize the Egyptian army. When they arrived in Egypt, they found that most of the Egyptian army, even the officers, were illiterate. And so these veterans of Vicksburg and Gettysburg got into the school-making business. They built schools to teach literacy to Egyptian soldiers. And when the soldiers showed up with their children, they began to teach their children as well. And while they were teaching literacy, these veterans began to impart American ideals to their students, including civic virtues, patriotism, and democracy. I was amazed by this story. I ran off to the library, tried to find out more about the experience of these officers in Egypt, in fact, found very little. What I did discover was that there were numerous books on the history of Great Britain in the Middle East, history of France in the Middle East, but not one book, not one comprehensive survey of American history in the Middle East, American involvement, something that would have put these officers' extraordinary experience in Egypt in the 1860s in some type of historical context. Flash forward several decades to the aftermath of 9/11. And suddenly, the need for Americans to place their Middle Eastern involvement in some type of historical context became acute. Suddenly, Americans were being asked once again to make fateful decisions in the Middle East, decisions that would impact not only their security, but the security of much of the world. And therefore, back in 2002, when I met with my editor in a restaurant in New York, and he leaned across the table and said, "Michael, what is the one book about the Middle East that has not been written, but which absolutely must be written?" I did not hesitate a nanosecond. America in the Middle East. And then the great challenge arose. Some of you may remember my previous book about the Six-Day War in 1967. I wrote about 6 days, and now I had contracted to write about 230 years. And I had to find some means of uniting this long and complex narrative, some underlying themes that would bind this chronicle together. And the first theme that I identified was that of power. Power, the most obvious theme, the pursuit of America's vital interests in the Middle East through the application of power, whether it be military power, diplomatic power, economic power. Power certainly described the situation facing the United States in the 1780s as it confronted the Barbary pirate threat. In the spring of 1787, as representatives from these states convened in Philadelphia to discuss the possibility of whether to unite these states under a federal constitution, these pirates had captured 127 American seamen. America was facing its first hostage crisis in the Middle East. And again, no federal government, no navy, no means of fighting back. And indeed, if you go into the ratification debates surrounding the Constitution, you will find that representatives not only from the maritime states of New England, saying if we don't have a federal government, we can't have a navy. If we don't have a navy, our commerce and our nation will die. But you also find representatives from southern states who are not involved in foreign sea trade saying if we do not have a federal government, we can't have a navy. And if we don't have a navy, we'll have Algerines, as they were used to be called, Algerians, on the shores of North Carolina, and they will be enslaving our sons and our daughters. And so America did unite. And 5 years after the ratification of the Constitution, the U.S. Congress passed a bill signed into law by George Washington allocating $688,886.33 for the creation of the American Navy, 6 frigates. And that bill says specifically that these boats are being constructed to fight in the Middle East. And a long and bloody and often disappointing war ensued, America's longest overseas military conflict, its first conflict abroad. The first American servicemen to fight and fall in battle overseas fell and fought in the Middle East. The Barbary Wars, 1783 to 1815, with many, many setbacks at first. And not until 1805 did those 9 Marines, together with 250 mercenaries, march 500 miles across the Libyan desert to attack the Tripoli on its shores. That's that line in the Marine hymns. Not until 1815 did Stephen Decatur, an admiral for whom about 27 cities in this country are named, did Stephen Decatur sail his fleet into Tunis and Tripoli Harbor and finally vanquish the pirates? America had learned its first lessons in power from the Middle East. A mortal threat from the region had forced these disparate states to coalesce into united states, a singular as opposed to a plural noun. They had forced the United States to create naval power for the first time, and the first time to project that power thousands of miles from America's shores. And for creating a navy not to rule the waves, but to free those waves, America opened up the seaways to the Middle East to the agents of American faith. Faith is the second underlying theme that I identified. And by faith, I mean this almost irrepressible missionary urge to impart America's religious faith, and that is primarily Protestant faith, to the peoples of the Middle East, whether they be Muslims, Druze, Jews, or otherwise. But the faith also in America had a flip side. It had a secular civic side, a no less irrepressible urge to impart America's ideals of democracy, republican government, respect for human rights to the world. This is the faith of a colonial America that saw itself as the city on the hill, a freedom-bearing light to all of humanity. This was also the colonial America that saw itself as the embodiment of the biblical Israel that was escaping from bondage in England, crossing the great desert of the Atlantic Ocean, and occupying and settling a new promised land, the New Canaan. Indeed, New Canaan was one of 1,000 biblical names given by these Puritans and their descendants to their new cities and towns in the New World. They gave biblical names to their children, the Davids and the Isaacs and the Rebekahs and the Sarahs. They made Hebrew a mandatory subject at their universities. James Madison was a Hebrew major at Princeton. They put Hebrew in the logo of Yale, logo of Dartmouth, and logo of Columbia. It's interesting. In 1783, at the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, there was a contest in Congress over the great seal of this newly independent nation. One faction in Congress proposed that the great seal of the United States be the American bald eagle, clutching in its talons 13 arrows, one for each state. But a close contender showed Moses crossing the desert with the children of Israel behind him, following the pillar of smoke into the promised land. And there was a close contest in Congress, and that eagle won by a narrow, narrow margin. We came this close to having Moses as the symbol of the United States, and that symbol of Moses was proposed by Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. And since these Puritans and descendants had defined themselves as the new Jews, they felt a particular attachment to the old Jews. Not that they knew so many of them. There were only about 0.04% of America's population in 1776 was Jewish, but to this biblical notion of the old Jews. And the Puritans and their descendants felt a personal attachment to the old promised land, then known as Palestine, part of the Ottoman Empire, and many of them concluded that it was incumbent upon them as good Christians, as good Americans, to assist God in fulfilling his biblical prophecies to the Jews, his promises, to rescue them from exile and restore them to their ancient sovereignty in this promised land, the notion of restorationism. And so, 3 years after the conclusion of the Barbary Wars in 1818, America's first missionaries to the Middle East, two gentlemen by the name of Pliny Fisk and Levi Parsons, left Old South Church in Boston for the Middle East. Their primary objective was to help the Jews ingather into Palestine, where they would then form their sovereign state, and they would all convert en masse to Christianity. And failing that, they hoped to convert the other peoples of the Middle East, beginning with the Muslims. To their chagrin, Fisk and Parsons discovered that the Jews in the Middle East did not want to ingather under their auspices, did not want to convert to Congregationalist Protestantism. They further found that by trying to convert the Muslims of the Middle East, they risked losing their heads, because proselytizing under Islam is a capital offense. And so
with a sense of frustration, but also inspiration, they turned to building schools. Fisk and Parson built the first modern elementary schools in the Middle East. Later, they built the first secondary schools in the Middle East. And their descendants, on about 1860s, began to build the Middle East's first modern universities, what later would become the American University of Beirut, the American University of Cairo. And through these universities, they no longer preached the gospel of Christianity. They preached what they called the gospel of Americanism. Again, civic virtues, patriotism, and democracy. And they began to generate an entirely new identity in the Middle East, one that didn't exist before at all, called Arab nationalism. That identity which held that all speakers of the Arabic language, irrespective of their faith, they could be Muslims, they could be Christians, they could be Jews and Druze, irrespective of their faith, were part of the same national identity and destiny. And the missionaries and their sons, grandsons, became closely identified with this Arab nationalist idea. Many of them went into the State Department. They became the Arabists. Others went into the oil companies, became executives, as oil, starting in the late 1930s, began to exert an increasing influence over America's policies in the Middle East. And to the degree that Arab nationalism in the aftermath of World War I began to clash with the new name of Restorationism, that is Zionism, there was a fundamental clash between these descendants of their missionaries and the original missionaries' original impulse to recreate the Jewish state. But back in the United States, the Restorationist movement continued to grow and to grow. You had John Adams, the second president of the United States, expressing the hope that one day 100,000 Jewish soldiers, as well-disciplined as the French army, and that is the French army back then, would march back into Palestine and reclaim it as a Judean kingdom. Asked in 1863 what he thought about the restorationist notion, Abraham Lincoln said that the dream of restoring the Jewish people to its ancestral homeland was one that was cherished by a great many Americans, and he expressed the hope that once the United States restored its own unity after the Civil War, that the United States could move to realize that dream. Perhaps the greatest single expression of the restorationist idea appeared in a book published in 1844 called Valley of the Visions, a big, thick, gray tome, which called on the U.S. government to spearhead an international effort to detach Palestine from the Ottoman Empire and to give it back to the Jews as a state. The book went so far as to call on the U.S. Navy to help provision the state economically until it could stand on its own two legs. Valley of the Visions became an antebellum bestseller, went through about 30 printings, sold about 1 million copies before the outbreak of the Civil War, and it was authored by the chairman of the Scripture and Hebrew Department of New York University, a professor, George Bush. And 2 days in the genealogy department of the Library of Congress enabled me to ascertain that that Professor George Bush, author of Valley of the Visions in 1844, was a direct forebear of two American presidents by the same name. Some Americans, however, merely envisioning this recreated Jewish state was insufficient. Starting in the 1830s, groups of Americans, in particular American women, Clorinda Minor of Philadelphia, Harriet Livermore of Washington, picked up from the United States and moved to Palestine to create colonies there, the American colonies of Palestine. All of these colonies had the same goal. They all strove to teach the Jews how to farm. And these were good Jeffersonians. As good Jeffersonians, they believed that an agrarian economy was the basis of any modern state. And they understood that the Jews had been disenfranchised from their land for 2,000 years, and therefore they felt it was incumbent on them to reacquaint Jews with the agricultural way of life, which they had forgotten. And so they came to Palestine. They suffered terribly from disease, starvation, from attacks by Bedouin bands, but still they came. In 1855, Philip Dixon from Groton, Massachusetts, along with his wife and twin daughters, picked up and moved to a hillside outside of Jaffa. They called it Mount Hope. The Dixon daughters married two Lutheran brothers from Germany. Their names were Frederick and Johann Großsteinbeck. And the Dixons and the Großsteinbecks had this colony to teach the Jews how to farm. The Jews, for the most part, did not want to learn how to farm on this colony. And yet they persevered anyway in the face of terrible deprivations and terrible of disease and attacks. And still they came. 12 years later, George Adams from Indian River, Maine, followed by 156 artisans, farmers, merchants, picked up, moved to Palestine, again outside of Jaffa, and founded a colony dedicated to teaching the Jews how to farm, and they too suffered just monumentally. American Christian advocates of the recreated Jewish statehood in Palestine, and they're no less adamant detractors, would continue to differ well throughout the 20th century into this century. You just have to open up Jimmy Carter's book to see how deeply they continue to differ over this. But what is important to note is that whether they are in favor or against the recreated Jewish statehood, that both of these schools come from the same source. They come from the faith-based American approach to the Middle East. And finally, I come to the most elusive and mystical of these themes, and that is the theme of fantasy. And by fantasy, I mean it's the image of the Middle East as the realm of unbridled romanticism, exoticism, eroticism, the image of nomads with their robes streaming behind them, sweeping down out of the desert on their steeds and sweeping up some innocent Western damsel to take her off to some oasis and have her his way with them. It is the image of the Middle East first noted by John Ledyard, America's first explorer in the Middle East in 1788, a close friend of Thomas Jefferson who corresponded with him and gave him, as well as us, a glimpse of what the Middle East looked like to an American traveler in the 1780s. And John Ledyard first identified what he called the liberty-loving nomad. He saw the Arabs of the desert being very akin to the American frontiersmen out in Ohio. And he believed that just as the frontiersmen loved liberty, didn't want governments over them, that these Bedouin in the desert were the victims of a tyrannical government. And once that tyrannical government was removed by the United States, that these nomads would rise up and embrace that liberty. Sound familiar? The roots of this Middle Eastern fantasy in America are quite deep. They go back in Maine to the second most popular book on the colonial bookshelf, that is, of course, after the Bible. And that book was 1001 Arabian Nights, a collection of Persian tales. And you know many of the stories in them, Ali Baba, Sinbad the Sailor, Scheherazade, storytelling for her life. It's rife with erotic imagery of veiled but available harem girls, fantastic images of carpets circumnavigating various minarets in the Middle East. And many Americans read 1001 Nights, and they believed that this was actually what the Middle East looked like. And they were so enchanted by this book that they were lured to travel to the Middle East. First, John Ledyard, and then other explorers, and finally, thousands of Americans were lured to the Middle East, not merely by religious impulses, but for sheer joy of tourism. By the 1850s, Americans had surpassed the English as the largest single nationalist group touring the Middle East. We have all these memoirs of English travelers who are complaining that the Americans have snatched up all the good hotel rooms in Damascus in the 1850s. One of those Americans who set out for the Middle East, lured by this fantasy, was a writer whose previous book, Moby Dick, had sold a mere 3,000 copies, and he was very depressed by this, and he wanted to sort of identify some scintillating Middle Eastern source that can serve him as an inspiration for a more successful novel. In 1855, Herman Melville packed two shirts and a toothbrush and went off to the Middle East. He kept an absolutely vivid diary. If you ever have time, I recommend you read it. It's full of very postmodern and borderline hallucinogenic imagery. Extraordinary read. And he, to his chagrin, also found out that the Middle East bore absolutely no resemblance to what he had read in 1001 Nights, but it didn't stop other travelers from going there, other tourists, other writers 12 years later, an aspiring humorist originally from Missouri who had replanted himself to the Pacific coast near San Francisco came to the Middle East. He had a contract from two American papers to publish his collected dispatches from the region. His name was Samuel Clemens, but he published these collected dispatches as Innocents Abroad under his new pen name, Mark Twain, in which he includes some very caustic observations of the Middle East. Innocents Abroad, the Middle East, made Mark Twain. Innocents Abroad became the biggest selling book of the second half of the 19th century in the United States. It sold more copies, Twain used to quip, than the Bible itself. Twain, like Melville before him, found that the Middle East bore no resemblance whatsoever to 1001 Nights. They all did. And yet these Middle Eastern myths were so deep-seated, so ingrained in the American imagination that they persisted well into the 20th century, and soon they were appropriated by an industry which I know is dear to all of you, to Hollywood. Some of America's first blockbuster films were Middle East fantasy films. The Sheik of Araby, 1921, that propelled Rudolph Valentino to stardom. Again, this image of the nomad who rides out of the desert and sweeps this Western damsel away to his oasis. The song of the same name, the biggest hit of the 1920s, "I'm the Sheik of Araby, my heart belongs to thee, at night when you're asleep, into your tent I creep." Those of us of a certain age will remember the Maria Moldauer hit of 1974, "Midnight at the Oasis." It's the same song, it's just the woman inviting the nomad into her tent. There followed an almost unbroken series of 1001 Nights knockoff movies in Hollywood, the Ali Babas, the Sinbads, followed by just innumerable Middle Eastern fantasy movies, the Indiana Jones, the Saharas, the Hidalgos, those of you unfortunate enough to have seen that one. Mystified by these myths, Americans might have wondered why picturesque men in their flowing robes would lead their steeds, leave their camels on these oases, and travel to the distant United States, there to hijack airliners and to fly them into tall American buildings. Power, faith, and fantasy. Sometimes these themes exist independently in America's Middle East involvement. More often than not, though, they are in some type of tension with one another, if not open contention with one another. They weave through the narrative thread-like, binding it together. Fantasy, for example, met up with faith in 1855 when Melville visits the Dixon colony on Mount Hope outside of Jaffa. He writes about it in his memoirs, in his travel diary. Not a very flattering portrait of the Dixons, alas, but he has lunch with the Dixons, with the Grossteinbeck brothers, Johann and Frederick. A month after his visit, the Dixon colony was attacked by Bedouin bandits. Philip Dixon was knocked mortally on the head. His wife and two daughters were repeatedly and brutally raped. We actually have a deposition to the American consul in Jaffa about this terrible rape scene. Frederick Grossteinbeck was shot in the groin and died an agonizing and slow death. And the only person really to emerge unscathed from this attack was Johann Grossteinbeck, who, according to the American records, at that point left Palestine, moved to California, and Americanized his name. Melville would write movingly of this attack on the Dixon colony in his 18,000-line poem, Clarel. It's about this thick, and there's actually this rape scene of this American colony there. But so, too, would Johann Grossteinbeck's grandson, who would allude to this rape scene in his classic and biblical epics, East of Eden and Grapes of Wrath. John Steinbeck's grandfather had lunch with Herman Melville in 1855 in Palestine on a colony dedicated to the recreation of a Jewish state. Faith would mix in with fantasy once again in 1867, when the Quaker City steamship, the steamship that had brought Mark Twain to the Middle East with him aboard, helped evacuate the last 47 survivors of the George Adams colony from Jaffa, and Innocents Abroad again contains a moving passage of the terrible suffering of these American colonists in the Middle East. Power mixed up with faith in 1903, when Teddy Roosevelt sent battleships into Beirut Harbor to threaten the Ottoman government, whom he accused of mistreating American missionaries in the city. And faith grappled with power again in 1917, in the spring of that year, when the United States entered World War I against the Central Power, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. Woodrow Wilson immediately declared war against Germany and against Austria and Hungary, but then the question arose, would America join Britain and France in fighting in the Middle East? A strong bipartisan support in Congress arose for going to war against the Ottoman Empire. Teddy Roosevelt, a very popular former president, declared that the whole declaration of going to the war to save the world for democracy would be meaningless, and thus the United States tore down the tyranny of Ottoman rule. But Woodrow Wilson also had another group who was exerting pressure over him, the missionaries. Now, many thousands of people operating in the Middle East for a century, and these missionaries came to Woodrow Wilson and said, if you go to war in the Middle East against the Turks will do to these missionaries what they have been doing to the Armenians. They have been massacring the Armenians by the hundreds of thousands. Woodrow Wilson, the grandson, the son, and the nephew of Presbyterian ministers, decided ultimately not to go to war in the Middle East. Decision that was just rife with massive ramifications for the political future of the region, because at the end of World War I, there were 1 million British soldiers in the Middle East, several hundred thousand French soldiers in the Middle East, and not one American trooper anywhere. Guess who got to draw the post-World War I map of the Middle East? Not the United States. And finally, faith trumped power once again in 1948. When in the aftermath of the UN decision to partition Palestine into an independent Arab and an independent Jewish state, the United States in mid-May of 1948 was pressed with the situation of whether to recognize the Jewish state that was poised to come into being on May 14th. In a situation that was completely unique in the annals of American foreign policy, the entire American foreign policy establishment, the State Department, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, agreed that if the United States recognized the soon-to-be-created Jewish state, it would result in a global catastrophe. The Arabs would go over to the Soviet camp in the Cold War. There would be a cutoff of oil supplies to the West. Europe would fall to communism. And perhaps more disastrously still, the Jews of Palestine would be incapable of defending themselves from the Arab onslaught that was sure to come, and the United States Army would have to intervene militarily in Palestine to save them. All of these warnings were presented to the president. His name was Harry S. Truman. Harry Truman, who had grown up in a strict Baptist household, had learned most of the Bible by heart by age 14. He listened to all of these arguments on May 13th, 1948. He listened as his own Secretary of State, George Marshall, probably the most revered American of his generation, said, "Mr. President, if you recognize this Jewish state, I, George Marshall, will not vote for you in the 1948 presidential elections." Imagine that. Harry Truman locked himself up in the White House for about 24 hours. We don't know what went through his mind. All we do know is that at 6:11 on May 14th, Washington time, 11 minutes after Israel had declared its independence, Harry Truman made the United States the first nation on earth to recognize the recreated Jewish state of Israel. We don't know why he did it. All we know is that several weeks later, there was a high-ranking delegation of American Jews to the White House, and they happened to run in the hallway right into President Harry Truman. And Truman was introduced to them as the president who had helped create Israel. And Truman took deep umbrage at this. He said, "Helped create Israel? Helped create Israel?" He said, "I'm Cyrus. I'm Cyrus." Cyrus, of course, being the Persian king who restored the Jewish people to their sovereignty at the time of the Second Temple. Since 1948, since America's ascendancy as the primary Western power in the Middle East, replacing Britain and France, with America's deepening dependence on Middle East sources of oil, Americans have struggled mightily to reconcile these competing themes and impulses of power, faith, and fantasy. The result has been an almost unchartable zigzagging in American foreign policy toward the region. For example, in 1953, the United States joined with Great Britain Great Britain, in overthrowing a popular nationalist Iranian prime minister named Mohammad Mossadegh, who the British and the Americans feared was becoming too close to the Soviets in the Cold War. But 3 years later, the same American administration, the Eisenhower administration, turned on the British, as well as on the French, to save another Middle East nationalist leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, from almost certain overthrow in the Suez Crisis. American forces have been actively engaged in combat against the forces of Libya, of Syria, and Iran. And yet, though it is widely forgotten, not only in the region, but in this country as well, America played an instrumental role in achieving the independence of Libya, Syria, and Iran. American presidents have supported the state of Israel, and yet at crucial junctures, other presidents have levied arms embargoes on the Jewish state and have pressured Israeli leaders to relinquish territories which many of those leaders felt were vital for Israel's security. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan beefed up Saddam Hussein as a foil to Iran and then turned around and sold arms to Iran in an attempt to induce the Iranians to kidnap fewer Americans in Lebanon, basically violating Thomas Jefferson's first law of the Barbary Wars that the more you bribe the pirates, the more piracy you're going to get. American leaders have strove to establish a Pax Americana in the Middle East, and yet American troops have been engaged almost uninterruptedly since 1979 in what is nearly a 30 years war in the Middle East, a 30 years war in which we in the United States have watched as the uniforms of American servicewomen and men have burnished from a light Vietnamese green in the 1970s to a tawny Arabian brown today. Then, in 2003, America invaded Iraq. And for one gleaming minute, it seemed, the bearers of American power were patrolling the fabled capital of 1001 Nights. That's Baghdad. And they were there to impart democracy on a population that seemed ever so eager to rise up and embrace it. That moment has proven fleeting. Today, Americans must once again strive to balance the pursuit of their vital interests in this region with the precepts of their ideals, all the while distinguishing between the real and the mythical in the Middle East. That task is gargantuan. My book, alas, does not prescribe a path for achieving this. As an historian, I always say, I have enough problem predicting the past. And yet, I do want to share with you and with all of my readers my fascination with this extraordinary legacy. I want to tell you why the original Lady Liberty was an Arab woman with a veil holding a torch. I want to tell you why the original lyrics of the Star Spangled Banner spoke of humbled Middle Easterners bowing down to the victorious American flags. To hear all those stories, I guess you're just going to have to read this book. Sorry. I think far more crucially, though, I want to instill you and indeed all of my readers with an appreciation of this extraordinary heritage of America in the Middle East. It's a legacy of militancy, yes, at times, and of greed, but also one of generosity, of tolerance, and of courage. My aim is to provide a context for Americans who are now profoundly, and some would even say existentially, involved in the Middle East, a context of the past in which they can begin to chart their future. Thank you. Thank you all. I have my water, and you have the floor to ask questions, so please do. And we have a microphone here.
I want to ask, you said President Jefferson had an envoy to Tripoli.
And he was the envoy to a discussion with a representative of the Pasha of Tripoli.
I see. And what year was that?
1785. March of 1785.
Okay. And
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
It's okay. Take your time.
I recently read your article in the New Republic about Iran. Mm-hmm. So if I can, since you mentioned Persia, I would wanted to ask a question about Syria.
Please.
Do you feel the U.S. should be engaged in trying to peel Syria off from the alliance with Iran and Hezbollah? Do you think there's any validity to that approach, or that's just a waste of time?
You ask a hard question for me because it's undecided in my mind right now myself. The article the gentleman is referring to appeared, I guess, last week in the New Republic. It was a rare sort of journey on my part into reportage. It's not history. I actually interviewed, along with my colleague in Israel, Yossi Kleiner-Levy, interviewed senior members of the Mossad, of the Israeli Army intelligence, Israeli policymakers about their feelings about Iran. And sort of to give you the 30-second version of what this article says, not to save you the trouble of reading it, it says that, that the Israelis uniformly agree that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel. That is very much in distinction to the United States, as opposed to Israel, that the Iranian regime is an extremely aggressive regime. It's a apocalyptic regime that is willing to risk as much as 50% of its entire population to destroy the state of Israel. It daily promises to wipe Israel off the map. It's not even reported here anymore. And that that once Iran nuclearizes, not only will we have the danger of Ahmadinejad and others pushing a button and eliminating Israel, we're a one-bomb country. Our second strike really has no meaning, for us anyway. That it's also a further danger that once Iran nuclearizes, the entire community around which, in which we're situated, will go nuclear. The Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Saudis have all got on record saying they want a nuclear weapon too. So we will soon be inhabiting a nuclear neighborhood in which Israel's ability to respond even to one terrorist missile, say from Hezbollah, will be reduced to zero. Literally, this will render the Israel, if not great swaths of the Middle East, uninhabitable. We also found that there is great amount of skepticism among Israeli intelligence officials and policymakers about the ability of sanctions to bring about a change of attitudes in Iran, very skeptical about the ability or even the willingness of the Bush administration to act. This we also found from talking to congressmen in Washington from the Democratic Party who felt that if George Bush moved against Iran, that they would move to impeach him rather quickly. So Israel then is left with the choice how then it can act, and there's where the consensus breaks down. The consensus breaks down over the extent of the Iranian response to Israel, whether Iran will respond with several missiles or whether it will respond with hundreds of missiles, and then more poignantly, whether the Syrians will join in that response. And the Syrians have thousands of SS-21 missiles that have targeted all of Israel's cities. They have chemical warheads. And so there's a certain sector of the Israeli community that believes that giving back the Golan Heights to Syria as part of a peace deal is a not prohibitive price to pay to knock Syria out of Iran's orbit and keep Syria out of the war. Now, that is a long way of getting to the point about America. Some of you may have seen my New York Times op-ed about a week and a half ago also, where I talked about, I put this in historical context, as I want to do, and that said that Israel Israelis and Arabs have several times over the course of the last 30, 40 years have negotiated secretly without letting the Americans know about it or know much about it, and have only brought the Americans in at the last stage. What distinguished this particular talks between Israelis and Syrians, and these are the Israelis who believe that they should be negotiating with the Syrians to knock Syria out of Iran's orbit, is that the Bush administration is not happy about these negotiations, and that these Israelis, by negotiating with Syria, risk a certain amount of clashing with the Bush administration. The Bush administration regards Syria as an honorary member of the Axis of Evil, believes that Syria has opened its borders to insurgents in Iraq, believes that Syria is undermining the democratically elected government in Lebanon, and doesn't want to let Syria off the hook by having it cut a separate deal with the Israelis. This is really where there purports to be a breakdown in what is usually a very close alliance between the Israeli and American leaderships. Now, should the United States look with favor on these negotiations? I'm inclined to say no, but only because I believe that I don't believe that cutting a deal with Syria is any guarantee whatsoever that Syria won't join in a war anyway. All right, we only have the word of Bashar al-Assad that he won't attack if Iran does, and I'm not willing to stake Israel's security on his word. And so you'll be giving back an immense concrete asset in return for what is a promise from a very vicious and perhaps short-lived dictator. And I don't know whether it's worthwhile right now to risk a clash with this administration or indeed any American administration. I give a premium value to the American-Israel relationship. So I'm sorry, that's a very long-winded way of responding to your question, but to understand my approach to it, I had to really basically summarize that article. Oh, you know, I don't even know what day today is. So Saturday a week ago? Okay. Yeah. Right. Sorry. Okay, please.
The secret negotiations that you talked about that led to the Oslo Accords. Can you talk about Israel and the United States' change of heart, so to speak, with Fetz and the PLO, as opposed to now they're according them against the elected Hamas government?
I can't understand your last sentence. So, with the
the change of policy regarding the PLO and particularly Fetz as a terrorist organization, and now courting them against the elected Hamas government. Mm. What brought about that change?
The Oslo Accords of 1993, September 1993, were one of those examples in which Israelis and Arabs, in this case Palestinians, negotiated separately, and did not bring in the United States in until about 2 days before the signing of the accords in Washington, President Clinton at that point joined the process and really threw himself behind that process. He put immense amounts of presidential prestige and presidential time into that negotiation at a series of summit meetings in Cairo, at the Y plantation outside of Washington, and finally at the second Camp David summit, first one, of course, between Jimmy Carter, Menachem Begin, and Anwar Sadat back in 1979, the second at Camp David summit in the summer of 2000, in which President Clinton devoted 13 presidential days. It's an extraordinary amount of time for an American leader. And at the end of that summit, the negotiations broke down and violence erupted in the Middle East. Now, you have three versions of what transpired at Camp David. You have an Israeli and you have an American version, and you have a Palestinian version. The American and the Israeli versions are virtually identical. According to the American and Israeli versions, the U.S. and Israel offered the Palestinians a Palestinian state in all of Gaza, about 95.6% of the West Bank, half of Jerusalem. They offered to compensate the Palestinians for that 4.5% they weren't getting in the West Bank, because that's where the settlements were all going to be concentrated, with land in the Negev, which would be adjacent to the Gaza Strip. And Clinton also offered to create a $30 billion fund for refugee resettlement. The Palestinian version, Arafat's version, is that the United States and Israel did not offer the Palestinians an independent state, but only non-contiguous bantustans in the West Bank, without a capital in Jerusalem. You can choose which of these versions you accept. Obviously, Dennis Ross, Bill Clinton, and Ehud Barak, the then Prime Minister of Israel, agree on their version. If you read Bill Clinton's memoirs, Arafat came to him at the end of Camp David and said, after Arafat had refused to sign on the dotted line, and said to, you know, thank you, Mr. President, you're a great man. And Bill Clinton looked at him and said, no, I'm not a great man, I'm a failure, and you've made me one. But if you read Jimmy Carter's recent book, you'll see that the Clinton, Dennis Ross, and Ehud Barak versions are not mentioned. Only Arafat's version is mentioned. So you can pew your chick. From that point on, when the new administration came in under George Bush approached this, having seen that Clinton had spent so much time with Arafat on this issue, he kept his distance from it. He did, however, send Colin Powell to the Middle East to meet with Arafat, and that what attempt to establish trust with Arafat broke down after the Karine A incident in 2002. Karine A being an arms ship that was sent from Iran to provide advanced weaponry to the Palestinians. Arafat denied having commissioned that ship, but mounting evidence, documentary showed that in fact he had. And from that point on, Bush wiped his hands of Yasser Arafat, and really until his death. Then there was an election in the West Bank and Gaza, in which Hamas came into power. And the Bush administration had been saying it wanted democracy in the Middle East. It got democracy in the Middle East. This was really, really the fullest democratic elections held anywhere in the Arab world, much in way more freer in many ways than the Iraqi elections, in the sense that the American army wasn't there supervising it. And they elected Hamas. Now, Hamas has not met the three benchmarks established not only by the United States, but also by the quartet, that is the European Union, Russia, and the UN, for reestablishing this peace process and continuing international aid for the Palestinian Authority, those three benchmarks being recognition of previous agreements between Israel and the PLO, an end of terror, and recognition of the right of the State of Israel to exist. Now, most recently, there has been a Palestinian, basically mini civil war that has erupted, and the Saudis have now negotiated a truce between these between Hamas and al-Fatah under Mahmoud Abbas. The truce may end the fighting. I'm actually skeptical that it will, but it has not met any three of these benchmarks. In fact, the leaders of Hamas have said explicitly that they will never recognize the State of Israel. And so while Condoleezza Rice can travel to the Middle East frequently, and she does, and while America can put $100 million, as they've offered to, into the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas, currently, and I say this with I say this with no joy whatsoever, with a great amount of sadness, there does not seem to be much light on the horizon for moving this peace process forward, nor does this agreement between Hamas and al-Fatah augur some type of progress toward resolving this conflict. This gentleman right here in the front.
I would like you to situate the 2003 decision to go to Iraq in the history of American missionary zeal in Iraq. I was under the impression that Wolfowitz, Pearl, Doug Feith were all under the sway of Bernard Lewis's view of Arabs.
Which is? Because I'm a student of Bernard Lewis.
Well, his editorial in Wall Street Journal a few years ago, it was basically that they had to have democracy imposed on them, that they were incapable of arriving at it themselves.
Well, he did this out. I have many disagreements with my former mentor in society. He's still my mentor, my former professor with Bernard Lewis. I, in 2003, was asked to testify in front of Congress, the Subcommittee on Middle Eastern Affairs, on the Iraq War, and I came out strenuously against the war. I believe that I was invited to go to Congress, not because I'm an expert in Iraq, because I'm a historian of the Middle East, and I knew how Iraq had been created by the British, how it was sustained by the British, how it was sustained by the Ba'ath after the British, and that was by a preponderance of central and brutal force, which I did not believe that American society was constituted to exercise in the Middle East. It just wasn't able to. And I don't think I was wrong about that. Understand, go back to your original question, though, about the neoconservative role, Bernard Lewis's role, what they all have in common is I see them as very much operating out of the tradition of American faith, that neoconservatism is very much a faith, and it believes that within every, behind every human rib cage beats a heart that's yearning for American-style democracy, and I say that not with denigration, I want you to know. They believe this, and in many ways it's a very laudable belief. I personally don't believe that the people in the Middle East want the type of democracy that we have to offer because maybe they want to be able to cast ballots, but they don't necessarily want the breakdown of the central family. They don't want women's rights. They don't want children's rights. They don't want sexuality that's rife everywhere. I go through Los Angeles and I see a half-naked woman on every billboard, every poster. They don't want that. All right. So our type of democracy is our kind of freedom, which is a package. Democracy is not just casting a ballot. They don't want. But that was my personal opinion. It is very much... it is very much a manifestation of faith-guided policies in the Middle East, not necessarily Christian faith, but that secular civic faith, which goes back to the founding fathers, indeed beyond, to the Puritan roots of this nation, which saw this country as the city on the hill that didn't come into being for its own existence, but to bring enlightenment and freedom to mankind. The founding fathers disagreed on many, many things, but they never disagreed on this. America does not exist for itself. America exists for all the world. And so it is not an innovation. Now, yes, there was a level of Christian faith guidance too. That's why I mentioned the story of the forebear of George Bush, to show how far this goes back, and to show that the missionaries in the 19th century went very quickly from preaching Christianity to preaching democracy, just really overnight, that switch. And I see them as two sides of the same coin. To not understand these origins, to not understand these roots, is not understand how America got into Iraq. This is not to say, and I stress in no way to say, that it's all about faith, it's all about democracy, it's also about oil. Because there are many tyrannies on earth, but America chose to topple this tyranny, which happens to be around a lot of oil. And of course, power is involved here. And so is the fantasy of the the liberty-loving nomad, which I was, when I first read these letters of John Ledyard from 1788, I almost literally fell off my chair. Well, I got, there it is. And I kept on encountering it again and again and again. It's a very, very persistent myth in America's perceptions of the Middle East. This is why, not to belabor the point, this is why I wrote the book, to understand the historical context in which that brought us from A to Z, Z being Iraq, before we plot our course through another alphabet in the region. Avi, let me get some of the...
I want to ask you about something I haven't seen you write about. You recently spent a year at Harvard and Yale, mm-hmm. and I'm curious to hear your impressions both about academia's opinions of Israel and how they speak on it, and the student bodies, and what your impressions were about the American campus and Israel.
Stark impressions, needless to say. I taught this course. I taught America and the Middle East at Harvard and Yale last semester, and had just an astounding, remarkable experience there. I found that while faculties are deeply polarized and set in their ways about Israel, about America in the Middle East, about America, period, and that they really haven't progressed much from where they were in the 1970s and 1980s, not much room for flexibility there, I found in marked contrast to this, the student bodies were open to all sorts of ideas. I'm very, very curious. At Yale, I had over 200 students in this class. And many of these students were wearing Muslim head covering. They came from all different backgrounds. And very, very open to hearing different perspectives, different interpretations of their history. Not everybody agreed with what I had to say, and I enjoyed it tremendously. I learned immensely from them. The book was deeply enriched by my contact with these students, and I thank them all in my acknowledgments. You'll notice I'll thank, you know, History 101 at Harvard and 130 Middle Eastern Studies at Yale. Amazing. There much remains to be done, and I'm involved in several projects to establish departments of Israel studies at all of these universities. And much is being done about that to offer different perspectives on the Middle East. This is in no way, and I stress again, no way, to restrict other interpretations of what is going on in the Middle East. It's very important that students have access to a multiplicity of views about this crucial aspect of America's foreign policy, and indeed of their personal futures. Sir, does it with the beret?
Mm-hmm. I actually didn't come here to listen to Arab-Israeli conflict. I'm tired of that, listening to that. I came here because of your book, a very interesting subject. And with all humility, if I may give a little critique.
Please.
Which may be wrong since I haven't read your book.
No need for humility. Critique entirely, away.
Entirely.
Yes.
And with a question.
Yes.
The way you began your presentation today and the way you ended. Yeah. The way you began your presentation today and the way you ended struck me. You began with wanted us to imagine that scenario of the Middle Eastern one telling that, you know, we will enslave you, the infidel, whatever. And then, of course, when you narrated everything, looking at it, if for every engagement we had a dart.
Had a what?
We had a dart to throw.
A dart.
I'm seeing all the darts being thrown from here, landing there, and but one dart coming here on 9/11, and yet we are so enraged. So one for all those 230 years of darts. I think your presentation lacks, I mean, your narrative lacks that perspective. That is one. Second one is, and that's the second one, and that's it, is in your entire narrative that you said, there was one big void there, and the void I felt was the Middle East, besides its oil and red and flying carpets and all of that, contains something else, human beings, people. From your entire narrative, that seems to be missing. In other words, if you're telling the story of American on Middle East, somewhere down there, you also need to cover what do the people there feel about Americans. I mean, if you go, do they consider all Americans, all white men as one, meaning no distinction between Europe, colonialism, and American, all of that stuff. So that, you know, is a void.
It's a valid point.
Ending with a question. I'm sorry, I have not read enough of you, and I will. I mean, your presentation is excellent. Is it your intent, the purpose of your book, to tell the American people that you have a legacy that you did not know of militancy, of going there, of power and fantasizing there, and now please don't stop, keep going? Is that your intent? Thank you.
Okay, three excellent points. Let's see if I can encapsulate them. I do begin my narrative, as I begin the book, with the Barbary Wars, because it was America's first encounter with the Middle East. It was an encounter of power. The book is, it presents chapters of, the first chapter is called America's First Encounters with the Middle East, for example, which covers not only the Barbary Wars, it also covers missionary activity, it covers adventures to the region, the establishment of these schools, and I'm showing that these events are occurring simultaneously. But it is indeed true that America's first encounter with the Middle East starts with a Middle Eastern dart thrown at the United States, in which the United States did nothing to provoke. And toward the end of the narrative, though the narrative continues to as close to the present as I can get, it includes 9/11, which was another dart thrown at the United States. And they do form sort of a bookends of the story. One of the interesting notes that's included in the book was the fate of the USS Constitution, which is anchored in Boston Harbor. It was one of the original six frigates created by Congress in 1794 to fight in the Middle East. Visitors were somehow astonished to find in 2001 that the USS Constitution was closed by Homeland Security for 2 years to tourists. The reason being, the United States security officials had determined that while Americans may have forgotten the fact that the USS Constitution had participated in the Barbary Wars, Al-Qaeda had not, and had targeted the USS Constitution for explosion, and was closed. Now, in between these two bookends, if you will, and I don't want to deter anybody from reading this book, there are about 650 pages of text. Which explores the vast spectrum of America's involvement in the Middle East, whether in education, hospitals, medical care, bringing freedom to the region, indeed, as well as taking vital resources out of the Middle East and not putting them back, supporting unsavory dictators, being involved in a very controversial Arab-Israeli conflict, all in there. My purpose was to show a multi-layered, multi-dimensional legacy. I was really asked about the teaching of Israel on American campuses. I know you don't want to talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict, but really the most influential book in the humanities, not just in Middle Eastern studies, of the last 30 years was Edward Said's 1979 book, Orientalism, which depicts all of American, indeed all Western involvement in the Middle East as the product of bigotry, intolerance, aggression, and imperialism. And while all of those factors are undoubtedly there, I felt that Orientalist tool, that approach, was inaccurate. It was certainly inaccurate for the United States, which wasn't involved in imperialism in any strike reform in the Middle East, no matter how you interpret it, before not World War II. And that if we are to truly begin to understand and appreciate and analyze our involvement in the Middle East, we're going to need a much more versatile tool. That was my objective. Now, there's one other point you made and I wanted to address. Did I get?
I said about the void of the people.
Oh, avoid it. This is an excellent point. And it comes up again and again, and I knew it was going to come up, and I addressed it in the introduction. This is not a book about the Middle East involvement with America. It's a story about America's involvement in the Middle East. It is, in that way, a one-way type of book. If I were to write the book of the two-way relationship, the book would be about 4,000 pages long. Moreover, I'd encounter a fundamental methodological impossibility. American archives are open. I can go into the Thomas Jefferson papers at Princeton. I can go into the John Jay papers at Columbia. I can go into the Library of Congress. Middle Eastern archives are closed. To the degree that the Middle East archives are open, such as the Ottoman archives, I went into them, and you'll see references to the Ottoman archives. Wherever I can in the book, I pause to reflect on what Middle Eastern people are reacting to America's involvement in there. At the end of the day, and I'll be the first one to admit this, it's still lacking in that dimension. This is a comprehensive book. It is by no means an exhausted book. And one of the things I hope to do with this book was to, in many ways, inaugurate a different field of study, the study of American involvement in the Middle East. And I hope that if some students out there read this book and are inspired by it, that they will go and write the book that I couldn't write right now. And that was the book about the way America is perceived by Middle Easterners. And you're absolutely right. Thank you all. Thanks.
A Loud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.